Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm Billy Walker.
And I'm Charles Bromesco.
On the show this week, Marrying Jesus Ain't All It's Cracked Up to Be on Immaculate, and I spoke to its wonderful director, Michael Mohan, Crime Doesn't Pay in The Delinquents, and on Film Club, it's more nuns going through it on Black Narcissus. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, welcome back. Billy, it's lovely to have you again. We just sat through a film that is going to be the subject of next week, but so we probably shouldn't, like, for embargo reasons, get into that. But it's very exciting to have you back for kind of a cool feminist horror-y week, because that's kind of your niche.
Yeah, I guess it is. I've moved out of, like, niche just because I had to pay the bills, but it's nice to come back to something that I originally began with.
What was your first piece for Little White Lies?
Oh, my first piece for Little White Lies was actually about the fact that people were mad that Robert Pattinson was playing, that he couldn't play the guy from Twilight and a billionaire bat, and how they're both a fantasy. And yeah, so it wasn't actually horror related, but then I did the faux feminism of the hagsploitation boom piece, which was probably the more well-known one.
Yeah, no, I love that piece. But yeah, it does seem weird that, like, now with the sort of advent of all these, like, TikTok stars doing a lot of press stuff, that there is stuff like Robert Pattinson. How can you be so many different things? It's almost like you're acting.
An actor, yeah.
I do like that, like, every good movie Robert Pattinson does, there's a fresh round of, like, can you believe he's got this in him? Same exact thing happens with Kristen Stewart. Is that, like, people are so locked into their memories of Twilight that no number of good movies will overwrite that.
It's so mad that even now, when Kristen Stewart is doing Love Lies Bleeding press, she's still getting asked about Twilight for like entirety of interviews. And it's she literally asked someone to stretch her.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. But like for me, I like Twilight was such like a formative cinematic experience for me, but like not in the way that you'd think. In that it's the first time that I was so bored in a film that I spent the entire one on my phone and just like gave up all of my understanding of cinema etiquette. I think I watched like the third one. My younger sister asked me to take her to it, and it's like one where they've like broken up and she's just like growing her hair real long. Yeah.
Who among us can't play, right?
I think that's the most relatable that Bella is ever. And then she's, for the rest of everything else, she's not relatable in that whole.
Did you go all out like to the midnight premieres with the people dressed up and everything?
That's literally the only one I saw. On my phone checking PerezHilton.com, because this was like 2006.
That's what we did back in the day, yeah.
I do remember that there was like, I didn't go to the midnight ones because I wasn't that much of a fan, but I do remember that there were people that would whoop and be like screaming like Team Jacob or Team Edward. And it was intense. People don't get that expressive anymore, I don't think, in the cinema.
They don't do the Avengers movies anymore. I guess they're done with those. But that's where you see the people like having paroxysms there in the theater.
Yeah. The fandom thing has kind of moved to let's make a fan cam about it later, rather than like I'm going to actually scream throughout this film.
Actually, thinking about it now, one of the most inspiring like public engagement displays that I saw recently, this was last year, last Valentine's Day, when they did in theaters in the US the 3D conversion of Titanic. which was fantastic. But this was February, keep in mind, before the summer, and they showed the trailer for Barbie, and everyone applauded at the end of the trailer.
Wow,
That is
that's
when I announced it was
commitment.
going to make $1 billion.
God. But I mean, yeah, the last time I had like a big massive reaction in the cinema, I think, was actually with the Northmen, with the point where they kiss. And I think it was like the opposite of the Avengers thing where everybody was just like, oh no.
I really liked, I went to see Jaws in when it was on at the BFI last year, and when everyone cheered for the shark blowing up, that was a really nice moment because it felt like, especially in somewhere like the BFI, which can sometimes like be a bit like the air can feel a bit still, it was really nice to have everyone have a really strong reaction to a film that they already have seen and know exactly what's coming.
Ah, see, there's a perfect segue into the topic that I wanted to bring up because my daughter's a bit of a kind of budding horror nerd, and Jaws is like the big question on the mind because technically it's a PG. I think my parents showed it to me when it was something like 2.5 or something ridiculous, and like she keeps asking to see it. So I've shown her like a couple of scenes where it's like just the power of suggestion. I've shown her the one where they kind of throw the leg of lamb off the dock, and like trying to get her into a few horror things. And it's something that I kind of bring up with Michael Mohan in our interview. But I'm wondering, what were your sort of like initial sort of introductions into the genre that made you fall in love with it?
I guess I think back to things that scared me, and I was never really scared of horror movies when I was a child. I was a weirdly rational kid where I was like, of course, I don't think in my everyday life I have to worry about zombies or vampires or what have you. I was very concerned about kidnappings and murderings. This was really the only thing that I was nervous about. And so I think the horror that I gravitated to when I was young was very monster based. You know, I saw Dracula when I was really little. I thought it was amazing. I was right. Although the first thing that I remember actually genuinely frightening me, and this is how you can tell I was pretty young, but there was a Disney Channel original movie called Don't Look Under the Bed, I believe it was called.
Yes.
Everybody familiar with this? Yeah. Where it was about a kid who is friends with a boogeyman. Like there's a boogeyman under his bed who befriends him, but then something happens in the movie. The boogeyman turns evil and like turns that he has like sharp teeth and like all these white irises in his eyeballs. Very scary stuff. And so I think when I think of the sensation of being frightened, that's one of my first memories of that.
Oh, I have to say, Joe, that feels in the same realm to me as that whole kind of R.L. Stine genre. I feel like people that love
Yeah.
that film love those, pretty
This was
melodramatic books as well.
in specific, I think, was definitely trying to like ride that kid-friendly line. But I ended up researching this later in life just because I was curious. And Disney got like a huge, huge influx of letters from parents being like, "This has upset my child. You have scarred my poor innocent son or perhaps daughter." I guess like they took it way too far. I don't know what the test audiences weren't telling them, but there was a big backlash against that. The other crazy thing I learned is there was a scene in the film where there's two of the characters is a little black boy, little white girl, and I think they're like, I don't know what age, but there was going to be a kiss, and the studio, Disney Channel, was like, "No, we can't show a black boy kissing a white girl on TV." This was the year 2000.
I'm not shocked by that because I remember in that same era I was a big boy meets girl person, not something that has aged particularly well. And there was a whole thing where Sean got a black girlfriend, and not one time did they kiss ever. And yes, in retrospect, that did feel like there was some insane politics going on behind the scenes of Disney, even in our kind of millennial youth.
Good Lord.
Billy, what about you? I feel like, representative of Gen Z. What were your formative experiences?
I'm a millennial, actually, technically, I guess. My experiences was like I got really into, well, first I sp spent a lot of time going down to the basement in the DVD shop and staring up at the shelves that I wasn't allowed to look at, the like 18 plus horror shelves that all had like the black and red covers, and just watching them and being like, one day. And then eventually my mum gave in, and I think I probably wasn't that old, I was probably about 12, and I picked Final Destination, which has scarred me for life, I think, because it just set me on a path of being anxious about every single thing that I could possibly be anxious about, like everyday object. I've gotten a lot better in the last 8 years, but it did take a long time to not think death was going to be a constant factor. I also loved watching Deep Blue Sea. I remember seeing that for the first time at my mate's house in one of those tiny TVs that were pink, and she had the video, and that started me off on sharks. So
you must whenever you're on the road behind a truck with like lumber on it, when
yes.
a lot of traveling trucks, you must just like be scared shitless.
Yeah.
And every time
that's
I'm outside the
destination
dentist
too,
and there's
though.
A pane of glass, yeah. all of the oh, just I just watched I quickly watched all of them because I wanted to see how they escaped death, and no one did. And then that didn't help because I couldn't win.
Yeah, of all the films that have kind of like I think about the most, I agree that like there's something about that motorway scene at the beginning of Final Destination 2 that comes up every time I'm on a motorway, which is like three times a week.
Why are you on motorways so much?
I don't know. Like, you know, I've got young children. It's just easier than getting the train quite a lot of the time. And either you go there, you come back. Like, that's two.
I'm confused. Are we not talking about like race cars, like a race car driving? Because that's what
no.
happens.
Motorway is a highway.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought you were referring to the Final Destination at a race car track where the people get murked by like the wheels and stuff.
Oh yeah, there is that one.
In the US, that's a motorway.
Oh no, it's the much more
highway.
Relatable.
Yeah,
there's
right.
a
yeah, so
car
the,
accident
the,
with
the
logs.
Transporting the logs, that is indeed on a highway road. I'm sorry, I'm all turned around here. This is a classic transatlantic mix-up right here.
Well, I mean, if there's anything that at least unites us, it's that Billy likes a film in which Michael Rapaport is mercilessly killed by some Mako sharks, and who can't get behind that? But Charles, like, I do feel like we should have like a moment of celebration. Like, I know that the podcast for a little while was like a little bit less frequent, and also the newsletter was a little less frequent, but you're kind of back with a bang.
Yeah. It's, you know, there obviously have been behind the scenes figuring out of things and reconfiguring and unconfiguring. Who knows what's going on? I genuinely don't. But what I do know is that the newsletter is going to be in your inbox at present twice per month, every other week. It is a lovely digest of my irreverent takes on entertainment news from the week, along with a sort of sampling of the new content on the site, all of our great interviews and reviews and articles, essays, things of that nature, and all delivered in the inimitable voice of yours truly. Not literally, I mean the written voice, it's not auditory, but yeah.
Wouldn't be a terrible service if we could just kind of get you reading it aloud. I mean, given the state of media, we probably couldn't pay you more, but you could read aloud the newsletter as a bonus thing.
A lot of people would be more motivated if they did not have to do reading. I definitely know some people like that who would rather listen to something than read something.
Well, I mean, for people that don't want to read but just want to listen, we can get on to our first discussion of our first film. It is Immaculate.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member, who receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Cecilia, an American nun of devout faith, embarks on a new journey in a remote convent in the picturesque Italian countryside. Cecilia's warm welcome quickly devolves into a nightmare as it becomes clear her new home harbours a sinister secret and unspeakable horrors. But before we get into the film, I got to chat to its delightful director, Michael Mohan.
Good morning, or good afternoon. Where are you?
London. Good afternoon. Oh. I've had a long and kind of storied day regarding all of like the wonderful stuff they gave us at the fabulous screening last night. My daughter was terrified by my t-shirt with like a Sydney Sweeney's bloody face on. And then I went to therapy and he asked, like, he's like, are you drinking a bottle of water that says holy water on it?
I love it. Love it. Well, you probably needed therapy after seeing the movie.
Very much so. But I'm so interested to kind of to get into this with you. So from what I understand, like, this was actually not a case of you casting Sydney Sweeney, but rather her thinking that you were the perfect person to direct this.
Yeah, she was my boss. She brought the script to me, and you know, we had been looking to do something together ever since we made The Voyeurs And she had sent me some other scripts in the past that I read and I loved, but I didn't think I was the right director for. But this one, it was a little bit different. This one, she was making it no matter what in that winter. So whether I was involved or not, this movie was going to be made. But still, I needed to love it, you know? So I when I read the script, I was terrified because I knew that a lot was riding on it. But when I got to the part, when I got to like the big sort of reveal that happened, I was shocked. I was so shocked. I thought it was so clever and so smart. And I write movies with twist endings, you know, so it takes a lot to fool me, you know. And when it was over, I just sort of had this vision for how this movie could comment on the moment that we're living in right now. And so I pitched sort of my take and my vision to Sydney and her producing partner, Jonathan DeVito, and her other producing partner, David Bernad, who she had worked on The White Lotus with. And we had our North Star. They responded positively. We had our North Star, and we just sort of hit the ground running with that in mind.
I mean, I absolutely adored The Voyeurs, which has just seemed to be so much. I mean, you seem to be a very like cine literate director, if that makes sense. Like, you know, like The Voyeurs harking back to that sort of heyday of the erotic thriller. And like this also seems to be speaking to a very like particular time in horror. Like, is that something that you're interested in, sort of like replicating aspects of films from the past?
Yeah, well, I think it's just what I, it's the kind of, it's what I watch. It's my media diet. You know, I feel like I, if you look at my Letterboxd, it's, you know, I try to find a balance between, you know, films in the Criterion Collection and trash. And I think I don't know why, but I really love the dichotomy between images that are very lurid, but that are shot very elegantly. And I think that's sort of, I guess that's sort of where my voice lives. And I'm very appreciative of Sydney, because Sydney's an actor who is completely fearless. Like, she wants to go there. She wants to push the envelope. And so, yeah, I just feel very grateful that she's chosen me to make her most fucked up movies. But in terms of this particular film, you know, yeah, we're harkening back to, you know, Rosemary's Baby in terms of, you know, it's very intimate, but it's very cinematic. But I also wanted to pay tribute to Italian horror, you know? And so I watched films like What Have You Done to Solange, or The Red Queen Kills Seven Times. And we even shot, our main location that we shot in was where Mario Bava shot Bay of Blood. And so I wanted to take from that too, because those films are very unique and distinct. And I just found a lot of inspiration in them.
It's funny that kind of, I mean, those are films that I absolutely love as well. And like, I would also kind of make the joke of that they're trash. But when you kind of look back, like what's more beautiful than a Dario Argento movie?
No, there's an elegance to that, to the filmmaking, that I think that me and my cinematographer, Elijah Christian, who I've worked with exclusively, he was my roommate in college. And so with everything that we do, from our first film was a $21,000 mumblecore movie, but we, even though we had no money, we wanted to shoot it beautifully because those films were lacking in aesthetics. And so our first film, we lit it. I was the one pushing the dolly and holding the boom microphone at the same time. And I think that sort of spirit is, we just carry it with us with every project we do, of trying to make films that look really pretty, you know.
Do you feel like comfortable with like embracing the sort of horror label? Because I mean, like, part of the film, like I felt like there was some like Friedkin in it, but then I was thinking about watching it, about how he always would insist that like The Exorcist wasn't a horror film, and like Jordan Peele insisted that Get Out isn't a horror film. Like, you just happy to like have it labeled as such?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wear it like a badge of honor. And I'm going to say, like, this is definitely not going to be my last one. One of the things that was so rewarding was finally getting to see this film with an audience, and to hear people screaming, to hear people yelling at the screen, and to feel that sense of catharsis at the end of it, even though it's very brutal. I mean, people were rooting for, you know, not to spoil the ending for your readers, but you know, what she does at the end of this movie is so fucking extreme, and people were cheering, you know? And to me, there's something just beautiful about, I don't know, being the host of this party amongst strangers, where they get to bond over their shared love of things that are sick and twisted. I mean, there's nothing more beautiful to me.
It's funny because it does feel that, like, when it kind of, it's like big action blockbusters are often spoken about as being like, oh, see this with a crowd, see this on like as big a screen as possible. But actually, like, what's better than the communal experience of being like disturbed?
I know. I mean, some of the memories that stick with me the most are, I mean, I still remember seeing Hereditary, and there's that moment where there's the woman up in the corner of the screen. And I was sitting there and I was watching the movie and I caught on late, but I kept hearing people gasping around me. And suddenly I was like, what are they gasping? Oh my God, holy shit, And that's marvelous. That's such a fun, it's just such a fun experience to have, And I think, I think we also need that. The trauma that we experience watching horror movies helps us deal with the trauma in our own lives, So I'm here for it. I don't care. Label me a horror director, label me exploitation, whatever they want to call me. I don't care. I did this is a horror movie and I wear that label with pride.
Do you at all sort of reject the label, which has become quite a controversial one, of like elevated?
Well, we were cognizant of it. I mean, if people want to call it elevated, great. That makes me sound smart. But I think this film, the only, I'm a little bit weary of using that label to describe this movie only because when I think of elevated horror, I think that there are going to be a lot of boring parts to it. And this movie's 88 minutes. It's very well paced. We also do have, like, I don't care. We have traditional jump scares. We have moments where there's like a woman standing behind you and you don't know she's there and it's punctuated by a big loud noise. And, I don't, to me, I love that. I love having those moments peppered in. But if people want to call it elevated, if that's going to get their friends into the theater, call it elevated. But I don't want it to alienate people from what is ultimately a fairly, like, commercially paced movie.
I think what's like great about the film is that it's not just jump scares. I think sometimes I'm a big horror person, and like sometimes you do come away from them where it's just like, oh, I just feel like I've just been like sort of not tricked, but a bit like that there wasn't much behind that. I'm like, how would you like define the scares? Because the gore is intense, like, but it's not
Yeah,
so.
well, I think what we were talking about is because the message of the movie, we want it to be heard and seen by as many people as possible. And so I tried to actually, like, you're a horror person, so I can explain this to you. So like I wanted to architect the film almost very traditionally so that when you start, you're almost lulled into the sense of, yes, it's a horror movie and yes, it's scary, but it's familiar. And then as the film goes on and it gets crazier and crazier and darker and darker and more and more and more extreme, you're kind of like a frog in a pot of boiling water, That was our intention behind it. And yeah, I'm very grateful that we had an actor as talented as Simona Tabasco to, help us set the tone in the prologue, because I think that helps.
Yeah, I mean, it is so true because the sort of like conventional wisdom is that like if you just sort of let the audience like fill in the gaps and you don't show them stuff, then they'll come up with something really horrible. But actually, I don't know that I could have come up with
Well,
this.
what's interesting is everything in the movie is absolutely plausible. As ridiculous as it might seem, all of the events that happen in this movie could happen. And I think, with the gore, it wasn't like we were trying to make a Peter Jackson, we weren't trying to do Dead Alive or anything like that. It's not extreme for extreme's sake. It's more just like if someone falls off of a four-story building and lands on their face, you're gonna see their skull poking through. And we wanted to capture that sense of, it's not gore for gore's sake, it's realism. And the realism is a lot more brutal than you typically see in movies like this.
Yeah, I mean it. Like I said, my daughter's
Yes.
traumatized.
And
She's
she only
in
saw the
the
t-shirt. How old is your daughter?
Seven.
Yeah, I have a 7-year-old too. She's never going to see this movie.
Well, one day. I mean, like, do you have that thing with kind of like the, I don't know, with your daughter of like kind of doing like the intro horror things, like, the sort of nightmare on Nightmare Before Christmas, like, I think Coraline, basically just Henry Selick in my mind, but
Yeah, eventually I'd like to expose her to all of that stuff. I mean, my own mother was really, I've wanted to be a filmmaker ever since I was 5 when I saw Back to the Future. like that completely, you know, I'm one of those people where it just completely, I grew up in a small town outside of Boston. It was kind of a cultural desert, and going to the movies was like, it was the coolest thing, and it was the only thing I had, you know? And when my mom saw that I was very serious about choosing this as a career path, she was the person who brought me to see Pulp Fiction when I was probably far too young. And so I credit her in terms of instilling me with this really sort of fucked up sense of humor, but also a love of cinema that aspires to achieve that. And so, yeah, I'm excited to one day show my kids those types of movies, but it'll be a little while.
You make me feel bad because I've already done a few of them.
Which ones have you done? What do you recommend?
Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, that would be fun. That's a
It's
good one.
an appetite for it, I think.
Yeah, I should do that. I'm going to show they would love that, because it's also a musical, you know.
And like, so you said like you're happy to like now stay in this space. Is this like something like you've got this like wonderful collaboration with Sydney Sweeney? Like, is this something that like the two of you both have like discussed about like revisiting as a genre?
I think for us, I mean, for me as a filmmaker, separate from Sydney, I just want to make as many films as I can before I die. And I want them to be as bold as possible. So whatever the genre is, you know, life's too short, and I want my legacy to be memorable, you know. In terms of what we work on together, we've talked about it, and our only stipulation is that we want to do something that scares us and challenges us. And so what form that takes, I don't know. But I think that based on the audience reaction that we had a few nights ago at South by Southwest, I mean, both of us were just like, we were on cloud nine. It was so fun to hear that crowd. And so I know that the two of us would definitely not be opposed to doing another horror film, but we just have to figure out what that is.
Thank you so much. I mean, part of me did think you were about to say life is so short, so I need to advise people to not move to an Italian monastery.
Life is
This is
so
my
short. Life is too short. There's no reason to live your life in celibacy, I think, is more important.
also solid advice. So Charles, I mean, Sydney Sweeney, kind of red hot property at the moment. She's managed prestige TV. She managed to make a rom-com that made, you know, not quite $1 billion like Barbie, but not far off. As a choice for her career, were you kind of surprised to see that she went with horror nun movie?
No, not necessarily. I actually think in terms of the trajectory that she's setting for herself, and if you read interviews, you can see that she is genuinely a very career conscious person. She's been speaking, I think last week or the week before, about how working on Madame Web sort of helped her create a good relationship with Sony, which got her onto a couple of other movies that she's more personally invested in. My point being, I think Immaculate makes a lot of sense as someone who is coming up, that it is not as far from center as the previous film that Sydney did with Michael Mohan, which is called The Voyeurs, a wonderful, really funny erotic thriller from 2019, I believe. This one is, I think, kind of more straight down the middle, not necessarily a negative thing, but I think it's a movie that wants to be and has the potential to be a hit. That this could be, you know, Blumhouse scale payday. I think that's what they have in mind for it. It's getting this sort of early spring release, which is not so far from the Megan slot of last year. And I think that, yeah, it's a great showcase for her talents. You can definitely see that there are sections of the script which she auditioned for as a 16-year-old, I think. And, you know, now that she's obviously got more juice, industry cachet, she returned to the script and acquired it from the writer and came on as a producer and set everything up to get this movie made with Mohan, who is someone that she's worked with for a long time now. And I think they've got a very trusting relationship. And so I think, yeah, it definitely makes sense for this point in her career. It's really something you can sink your teeth into, and horror pays, horror plays, you know.
I'm just wondering what you think about, you know, she's an actress who, you know, she's a very beautiful actress, you know, many actresses are, but she's someone who I think gets objectified a lot. And, you know, we're putting her in a nun's habit for the majority of this, but they do have a moment where, kind of for no reason, we see her getting undressed. Like, do you think that sort of is okay given the fact that she's like in producer role and so it doesn't feel as like leering?
Yeah, well, number one, you bring up the big point, which is that, and Mohan himself will be very upfront about this. She was the one calling the shots on set, that he was the director, but he was really not necessarily taking marching orders, but really collaboratively on even footing with her. And yeah, I get the sense that she's not really someone who can be made to do stuff she doesn't want to do in terms of her work. She seems to be very mindful about how she chooses her projects. But in terms of her presentation in the movie, I think what you're talking about, which is that America and I guess the Western world at large has gone completely out of their gourds over seeing this good-looking woman in the last month or so. That is kind of, pertinent to the text of the film. It is about a woman who, because of, her favor from God, let's call it, people around her are acting really weird, treating her either, as an object or weirdly obsequiously as if she's some kind of god. It's ultimately a movie about how she almost projects this field that makes people around her act weird. And that's one way to read the movie as, a sort of leering comment on women's bodies. But I don't think the movie itself reproduces that. I think it's critical about that.
Billy, I mean, did you find kind of that? I mean, there's kind of, it's a film that like does kind of wear its, I suppose, like more trashy sort of horror influences on its sleeve. But did you actually find the sort of comment on femininity interesting as well?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting given, like it's already been said, that she's chosen this as someone who is constantly getting, like, her breasts are constantly in conversation on every social media platform. And it's trying to say it without giving things away, because I saw the spoiler hint. I think, especially now, with the way bodily autonomy laws are going in America, and also we've got many problems in the UK, that it's interesting that she was so behind bringing this film forward, and that actually I do think it succeeds in like the last 10 minutes of a very visceral response to someone else having control over your body.
Yeah, no, it's a dark one. In terms of like what it's speaking to is almost like more horrific than the subject of the film itself. But I don't know, is it like, do you think it's like reductive to just kind of think of things in terms of like, is this feminist, is this not feminist? Because the poor things debate made me want to kind of claw my own eyes out.
I think,
Yeah, I agree. I think it gets kind of exhausting when you just every film that has a centers a woman becomes this like, oh, is it like an outright feminist narrative? Because it gets a bit tiring.
I always think of that question as really, it should be the beginning of a conversation rather than the end of it. This is, it seems like people are always trying to suss out like an answer, like, yes, it is, or no, it's not. Whereas that idea of whether something is or is not feminist should always be towards the bigger reading of what it is, what it's saying, what it's doing, how it does that. I think, yeah, people just aren't pushing far enough or like doing something interesting with that opinion.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also because women's liberation has become such a, it's not a small concept now. It's kind of widely disseminated through Instagram and consumerism and everything. So many things can be seen as a feminist film without actually having to do any work behind that.
In this kind of era of quote unquote elevated horror, A24 horror, as I feel like it should be more accurately labeled. Do you feel like this was legitimately scary? I suppose is a big question.
I was definitely, let's see. There's the part where everyone's pulling at her face, which made me scared of people pulling at my face. That's real. But this is the same thing. I mean, like, I can't, and I write about horror a lot, and I guess this is, I'm realizing right now that I have a horrible critical double standard where, like, I feel that it is not fair for me to grade a horror movie based on whether or not I find it scary, because I don't find most things scary. But there are certainly great horror movies that don't actually frighten me. However, if I am writing about a comedy film, I absolutely grade it based on whether or not I think it's funny. So I need to re-examine my practices, apparently.
I know you mean like comedy. I think next to horror is kind of like the most subjective thing in terms of like you're either scared or you're not. And in some ways, it's kind of unfair to rate it on those terms. I don't know that I've been aligned with the populace on a single funny thing. I don't find anything funny that's supposed to be.
Well, except for my tweets. You're very much in step with everyone that
But
those are.
I'm the only one.
No.
I think it's grosser than it is. I didn't get scared. I kind of got a few. There's two main moments where I got really grossed out before the end, and I think it could have gone a lot further with that. I think they really didn't push it as much as I wanted them to, and it's not really until the end that you're like, oh, I get why it's got a high certificate rating, because
Right, so
it's a lot
Yeah, no,
Say?
I was just going to say I don't want to get into details with the end, but I do think that that's like such a key scene. That's my favorite scene. I think there's a lot of interesting and very disturbing stuff with sound design there, a lot of really clever camera work. When you see it, you'll definitely know what I'm referring to and what I mean. But I have an article about that coming up soon. I interviewed the two of them, Sydney and Michael, about that final scene. And there technically a lot more went into that than I think is apparent just from watching it.
Yeah, I do feel like we're having to be extremely abstract talking about this because it just seemed to me to be a film that, like, the less you know, the better. Don't even think about the title too much. Just.
I was definitely happy going in knowing that it was nuns and that it was horror, and that's I got what I thought I was going to get. I could have gotten more, but I was happy with an amount.
I mean, did you see like the twist coming? Did you find it genuinely surprising, or was it just me being kind of a bit
I'm
of a dumb?
almost
Oh,
like, I don't even know there's a twist. It feels
that's
just
what I'm
like an
saying. It's the
inevitability.
premise of the movie right there in the title.
Yeah. Oh, wait, which bit's the twist? The end or the.
Or the thing itself, yeah.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's kind of two. There's like the premise unveiling itself as a twist, and then why it's happened, I think, is a pretty big fucking twist,
I guess,
guys.
yeah, okay,
Okay,
that's
yeah, no, the how it's ha yeah, the why it's happened was good. I
I'm
think
gonna be
it was.
like really annoying. It's like that's not a twist as much as it is like a denouement, right? That's like
Oh.
there are no nunneries, there are no convents where there is in movies where there isn't something dark and sinister happening. And so when it turns out that like they're doing, an unspecified evil thing, let's say, I'm like, yeah, well, of course, right? Because why else would they be acting so weird to her if not for
Yeah.
malign reasons? Yeah.
For a second, I was gonna say, "Sir, I put to you the Sound of Music," but actually, they were kind of like condoning
Nazis were there. Yeah. Interesting to see
Nazism.
that you don't think of the Nazis that way.
Score for Michael Rapaport. I mean, when it comes to like a nun horror movie, the most recent one we've had is The Nun, where we are kind of like, I suppose like the nun has become a bit like the clown, where we're supposed to kind of like find them inherently sinister. Like, what do you think it is about nuns?
I don't think nuns are scary. I think sometimes they're really sexy. Well, that's I'm thinking about Benedetta, but so I've never really understood why we're scared of them. But then also, I grew up in an atheist household, and I've never
That's what I was
experienced
about to guess. I was
Catholic
like, someone didn't go to
experience. Yeah,
Catholic
exactly.
school.
I did not. So my experience is fully through TV and film, and yeah, horror films. I'm more just intrigued by them than I am scared. But maybe that's also my. I'm as intrigued by sharks, so maybe I shouldn't be the one to answer that question.
I do actually. I have some thoughts on the matter because I years ago was working on a piece about the same concept, but in terms of pornography, like why is none porn a thing, whereas rabbi porn, female rabbi, is not. And the conclusion I came to is that Catholicism is like a very sex and fear-based religion. Catholicism is about putting the fear of God from in you from a very young age. And I think that can be very easily translated to horror, even if you
Yeah,
weren't
and also
really
easily translated to kink, right? Like that's a.
exactly, because it's all about, like guilt and shame and punishment and kneeling and all these things, which, yeah, I get it. I'm Jewish, but in the abstract, I get it.
I wonder whether it's about like, we talked about kind of like our formative experiences, the things that we were sort of taught to be like hyper aware of as children, where like, I suppose it's like the thing of like quicksand, clowns. Nuns, like this was such a big part of like the media I ingested, and then they just like didn't really appear in like my life as I got older.
There are not pits of quicksand all over London that you have to like hop around.
Evidently not. So in some ways, I'm a bit on guard. I'm like, where are the nuns? I've been
Yeah,
told
nuns and
they've
algebra, I've never had to do. I'm really confused. I think in most of these films as well, like the male clergymen freak me out more than the nuns do. Like they have more power and they wield it in horrific ways.
Nuns,
Thanks.
I think that Immaculate really gets at this, but nuns are basically groupies for God, groupies like for Jesus. And the male clergymen that you're talking about, I think, see themselves as like managers of the groupies, which is a very
Yeah, and
unsavory
everyone
position.
hates managers anyway, so.
Of course, of course. Ugh.
God, yeah. I mean, like, in terms of like statistics, Billy, I think that does like pass out in terms of like who you should be more fearful of. But I digress in terms of my criticism of the Catholic Church. Please forgive me. And they will, because that's kind of part of their vibe. should we get some scores on this? Billy, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
So I think for me, it was a 3 in anticipation. I'm always up for a bit of Catholic horror, and I went in pretty blind. And then it was a 4 on the day. I think the ending really sold it for me. It comes out as one of those kind of good for her horror movies that we've had a lot of recently. And yeah, Sydney Sweeney joins that nice little crowd. And then it's back to a 3, just because the more I think about it, the more they could have played a lot of things up. And up until the last 10 minutes, it's pretty straightforward and a bit safe.
No, very fair. Charles, what about you?
Yeah, I definitely went in with anticipation at a 4. I really, really was very impressed by The Voyeurs. It was not written about much, and I was really making noise for that one. But as for enjoyment, and I almost don't mean this as a slight against the film, because I think, as we were saying before, it knows what it wants to be in terms of aiming for sort of like a broad mode of horror. But my enjoyment's probably at a 3, because my tastes are definitely that I wanted it to be a little more throwback to non-exploitation, a little farther out there in terms of genre. And I know this is a genre that the director likes a lot. There's a great montage where the nuns are doing chores, and the score comes from an old giallo movie from 1972 called The Red Queen Kills 7 Times by Emilio Moralia. And so there's a nod to that, but because that's not really the dominant mode, I'm going to say 3 in enjoyment and a 3 in retrospect.
Oh, I think I'm a little bit higher than you guys. I think I'm kind of at a 3, 4, 4. I just had like such a hoot. I think part of it is just it being kind of so taut and such a kind of throwback to like films. Like, I love giallo so much, and kind of like that whole kind of Italian lack of subtlety that was like such a huge thing in the kind of 60s and 70s. Yeah, no, I had a great time. And I think because it, like, the final 5 minutes, I think, as we've mentioned, I think is the strongest 5 minutes. Like, to kind of leave it on a sort of bang, you know, really did work for me. Yeah, and you know, it was set in the same convent as Bay of Blood.
Yeah, same area. Well, I mean, so when you hear Italian countryside nunnery, you know, you start making assumptions. That's what it is.
Did you think they just like, so what happens? Do all the nuns have to leave for them to film it? Where do they put the nuns?
That's a good question, actually. I didn't ask about
And also,
that.
How are the nuns okay with everyone making Catholic horror films?
Maybe it was abandoned.
Who's making this decision?
It wasn't in use. I don't know.
Yes, maybe. Yeah, that would make more sense. This... I'm thinking about another nunnery that's next door that's like less decorated that might house everyone.
Well, I think one of the things that does like push Sydney Sweeney's character into, you know, this life is that like it's tough to be a nun out there. You need to probably get a few alternative streams of revenue, like, to just kind of keep a convent bills paid. Yeah, I mean, I suppose on from kind of like the extremely holy people to the extremely naughty people, you guys are about to tell me about the delinquents.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Bank employee Moran schemes to steal enough money to never work again, then confess and serve prison time while his colleague hides the cash. Soon, under investigative pressure, accomplice Roman meets a woman who transforms him forever. So, Billy, I must confess, I've done this exactly twice in my couple of years hosting the podcast, and Charles was here both times. I didn't watch Bullet Train a couple of years ago, and I wasn't able to watch The Delinquent, so I'm going to have to be in like a passive mode and just have you guys tell me about this. What did you think of The Delinquents?
I thought it was good. I think I like the idea of the crime thriller that's kind of, it shows you the slow life and the idea that this is what you're trying to accomplish by committing crime, is to get out, to break out of the 9-to-5 hellscape. I do think that it was a bit too long for what it was saying. I didn't really get a lot out of every single moment of its 3-hour runtime. And that's not to say I don't like 3-hour films. I've happily sat through Killers of the Flower Moon, so I don't want to end up in that band camp of people that don't want to sit for movies. But I just didn't feel like I needed to be there for the whole of it. And I don't think they did justice to the female lead that Roman's obsessed with. I think we got more of his obsession than why. There's quite a lot of films where men just kind of fall in love with women, and you're like, great. Other than her being gorgeous, I don't know what you're interested in. I guess that's, yeah, I was a bit lost there.
I mean, how would you define it, Charles? I mean, it kind of sounds like it's like a heisty thriller. Is that fair to say?
So it's definitely on the surface a heist. It is about, as you say, a bank employee who steals enough money. But I think there's more, and this is why it both is 3 hours and I think sustains those 3 hours, but it's more existential. It's like, it's less about the how of the robbing of the money, which is pretty simple. The guy really just walks out with it. But more the why, which is that this guy, you know, he works at this job he hates. He figures he has 25 years until retirement. And so he kind of works out this, I guess, equation of the soul, where he's like, I could work for 25 years at this job I hate, or I could take enough money to last me the rest of my life, turn myself in and go to jail for 3 years, and then live as a free man. And so I think a lot of the slowness in this movie, and it's a really opened up, really legato film, you know, for a heist movie, it is much stiller and quieter and slower than you would think. But I think that also is in keeping with this character, Moran, his whole desire to like live a simple life, to do nothing, to live calmly instead of having to go to work every day. I think being able to have that, I guess like leisure would be the word for it, is I think really in keeping with the belief system that he's laying out for us.
But does it kind of like have a layer of like social commentary that's like compelling in that regard? Like the idea that like the only way to sort of work this like, I don't know, late stage capitalist system is to rebel against it.
Yeah, for sure. That's absolutely what I thought about it. That is about the first. I thought of the movie Office Space a lot, which is also about guys who are like, there has to be something more to life than going to this terrible job I hate all the time. And Office Space, you know, is another movie that I think what Billy mentioned is not untrue, that the two male characters are definitely more fully drawn than the female character. Same deal with Office Space, because I think this movie is also really interested in the dynamics between men. It's not a coincidence that the two main characters, Moran and Roman, their names are kind of just a flip-flopped anagram of one another, because their relationship is sort of like yin and yang. I think they need one another, but they also resent one another, but they're kind of tied together because of the scheme. And I also think that, yeah, their relationship and its richness helps to fill out the 3 hours of this movie.
Oh, what, you didn't think that Jennifer Aniston in Office Space's character, sole beat being that she didn't like to wear so many badges, was like fleshed out?
I honestly, I relate to not wanting to wear the thing you're given. I've spent enough time in a polo, in a logo marked polo in my life. But yeah, I don't know. She doesn't get to do as much as my man Ron Livingston.
Pretty for you. Like, in terms of like what it actually had to say beyond kind of going through the beats of like heist, what we're going to do post heist, did you think it had anything interesting going on?
Yeah, I definitely think it did. I think it really does have a philosophy behind it that's kind of demonstrating that what we'd like ideally to live for is a lot more than the 9 to 5. And there's a particularly nice moment where he's talking about, you know, he's got this job so that he can pay for the bills for his apartment, so that he can occasionally buy a nice suit. And that's just a cyclical thing. And that's the point of it. And he's really tired of that point. And I think that's that resonates with a lot of us.
Media landscape, gonna media landscape. We can all certainly relate.
Obviously, with a 3-hour movie, you kind of have to start to open up the structure. And the most interesting thing is that they're almost like two acts within the second act, because, you know, the guys, they get away with it. It all works. And then a lot of the movie is just about them living their lives in the fallout of this, you know, job that they work together. They do it, essentially. They do it. And then, you know, there is some tension about whether or not they'll be found out or whatever. But eventually, the real substance of the movie is them figuring out that you have to, you know, once you're free from this job, then you have to start defining what your life is for yourself. You have to make a lot of, you know, difficult choices about what you want to do, what you believe in when you're not just working the job.
God, I mean, this actually relates to something that I'm kind of researching and writing at the moment, where the idea of 4-hour work weeks and so much of the pushback seems to be around like, but what do I do on day 5? And you just have to respond with like anything.
Literally anything else. It's interesting, his like prison time, because he does, there's a really good like chat with one of the guys that has more power in the prison, one of the other prisoners, that's just kind of about how, about our freedom and how actually we spend so much time with the internet and just through technology, that actually the one thing that prisoners do have more than we do is time away from this tech. And it's not suggesting that you know, that prisoners are more free than we are, but I guess it's saying that like we've all kind of chained ourselves to something.
No, it's a fascinating point. I remember reading recently about how something has flipped recently, where essentially the internet became the real world and we've all become outside of it, the thing that facilitates the internet. Like the priority is the online world.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way when you have to constantly self-promote all of your work, doesn't it?
I feel like the American version of this, because this is a Chilean film, right? This is a I think in America, people, this fantasy is not like figuring out the situation in which you don't have a job, but people just imagine having like a more nourishing, relaxing job. Like people don't fantasize about this. They're like, oh, if I could just move to a farm and sell maple syrup at the corner store and just live like that. And this movie, I think, even goes one step farther beyond that, where they're like, no, that's still working. You are not thinking far enough with this. It's a little radical. I mean, I'm like any American, I'm addicted to working as well. And this idea that you should really just be pursuing self-actualization in like a purer way is, it's a lot to wrap your head around.
I guess also that makes the length of it quite radical in a way, because it forces you to marinate in those thoughts. It's not like an hour and a half where you're like, anti-capitalist manifesto, here you go. It's like, you've really got to sit with that and be like, just slow down and stop.
Yeah, I mean, it's that whole thing, what's the hierarchy of needs, where it's like when we were kind of kids, we get taught that like the whole goal is that like you work towards self-actualization, and then like you're an adult and people are just like, heat, can I get heat? Can I get shelter?
That's, I mean, to go back to Office Space, that's the weirdest part of watching it now, where these people frustrated about work are all making pretty solid money in what is made to be a stable job. You know, there are layoffs, obviously, and that's the fly in the ointment. But yeah, I think when you are hard up for work, it's very hard to relate to someone who has work and is like, well, this blows.
I mean, it's when you watch old Sex and the City now also, and like Carrie Bradshaw is like living in like a gorgeous Manhattan apartment as a columnist.
Getting paid like $4 a word in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. Regular people, I think, get $4 a word, but like she's important. So she gets like six. I can't quite remember, but it was good Lord.
I do think, honestly, you know, we bring this up. I think they touch on this at Delinquents a little bit where the guys are like, we came in after the good part. Like we have inherited a kind of beshitted economy that our fathers, you know, previous generations didn't have to wrangle with as much as we do.
This is like, yeah, this is like the beginning of The Sopranos, isn't it? Where it's just like, you know, the idea that like, not only did you come in the sort of middle, like you actually came in after it's over. It's like that your entire career is sort of like 28 days later, like you missed it. And you're just having to deal with the horrors of the fallout.
Meaning. Wait, are you just talking about journalism right now or all jobs?
I think society, if I'm honest. Sorry, hopefully not so bad in the world of like audio editing and Bob doesn't have to get too depressed listening to this. Sorry, what is the line in The Sopranos? I feel like I need to kind of say it more articulately. Just like the best is already over.
He says, I feel like I came in at the end of things, right? I think it's literally, that's the line.
Yeah, well, The Delinquents and the wonderful Tony Soprano. Well, not wonderful, he did some terrible things. But but Tony Soprano, you know, like going through a similar existential malaise, it seems. Should we do scores, though? Billy, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I'm going to say two for anticipation because I just didn't know anything. Three for enjoyment, and then I would say four just for the ideas that I've been left with thinking about. And it's like, it isn't my favorite movie that I've watched recently, but I appreciate its message and that it forces you to sit with it.
Charles, what about you?
I didn't know much about the director going in, and I thought the whole thing sounded a little dry. And I think my anticipation was probably about like three, maybe even two, but I was really impressed. I was, really didn't know what it was going to be and was surprised by what it turned out to be. I would probably give it enjoyment a four and retrospect a four.
Oh, okay. That may have convinced me to actually do the work that I probably should have done pre-podcast. Next up, we're going back to Nuns, going through it. It's Black Narcissus for Film Club. A group of Anakin nuns is sent to the Himalayas. The climate is hostile and the nuns are housed in an odd old palace. They work to establish a school and a hospital, but slowly their focus shifts. So Charles, like, as nun movies go, what is better than this? Is this your first time coming to Black Narcissus?
No, this is, I put this on my Sight and Sound top 10. This is one of my favorite movies of all time. I've seen it, like, I think, I don't know, six or seven times. I love it so much in terms of movies about nuns, maybe even like movies about religion. For me, it doesn't get much better than this because it does attend to the things I was saying before. This is what I look for, is that there is sex and madness coursing through this movie, which was made in the 40s, like so long ago, and there is so much like white hot eros in here. It's so psychologically intense and expressionistic stylistically. Like Powell and Pressburger were doing all these incredible things with matte paintings and makeup, and I don't know, I love this movie. I couldn't love it anymore.
Oh God, I feel the absolute same way. I absolutely adore this movie, but like I feel far less articulate about it than you do, or I'm just like, hot, this movie's great, hot, like into it. Viscerally, it's very pleasing. But like, I mean, when was the first time you came to Black Narcissus? Is this like a kind of early formation, but you know, getting you into the world of cinema film?
This would have been when I was a teenager. This would have been when I was in high school, because there was a time just when I would Google like any filmmaker that Martin Scorsese had brought up before. If anyone that he said was one of the best, I was like, well, he's probably right. And so that's how I came to Powell and Pressburger. I think the first film from them that I saw was... I might have actually seen Peeping Tom before anything else, but I saw Black Narcissus at the time, and it revolves around a very simple idea, which is that if you are in a community that is basically of a single gender, you throw in one very attractive person of the opposite gender, everyone's going to start going insane. I remember in New York years ago, one of our friends from out of town came to visit. She was good looking, and like you could feel the pH in the air shift. It was the same vibe.
God, it's funny that you bring up the kind of Sight and Sound and the Martin Scorsese of it all, because I pretty sure going through my memories that everybody was allowed a Sight and Sound top 10. And I believe he was allowed Black Narcissus, but he got 15, which feels
He gets 15. Yeah, right. He's earned it. You can have 15 when you're Martin Scorsese.
Okay, I'm, you know, I'm very tired, Charles. Like,
I mean, the royal you.
Billy, what about you? It's just like, is your intro to Black Narcissus or a kind of return to a beloved favorite?
No, this was an intro for me, and it's one of those things where it's almost like the same thing of seeing the Simpsons version of Cape Fear before you see Cape Fear, and kind of just going back through Nun history in the wrong order. And I can see, it's nice to see where the, like, fanatic, I mean, not where exactly where it started, but where it, you know, where we fanned the flames of habit wearing hysteria.
So you've, like, kind of now sort of seen the influence of Black Narcissus throughout the many Nuns of your cinematic experiences.
Yeah, and I've kind of, like, you know, I'm more familiar with Bernadette, Paul Verhoeven's version of, like, Nun fantasies than Paul and Pressburger, which is strange, but it was really nice to actually get to see it.
But I think Benedetta is actually a really productive point of comparison, because much like Black Narcissus, it takes this idea that if you are all married to Jesus, there's going to be some jealousy over this guy you're all seeing. Like, things are really, really mean to each other in both of these films, but, like, in a very petty, almost high school way. Like, they're very gossipy, they're very judgmental. You know, obviously they're nuns, that's their whole thing. But just, like, the, you know, everyone says
that nuns' whole thing is being judgmental and petty.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that, you know, that's religion, right? You're being
judged. Take that, Catholicism.
I don't know. I'm not Catholic. I assume that was a big part of it. Am I wrong?
Again, also not a Catholic. We've got
We're a really ill-equipped group of people to be discussing all these nun movies.
Yeah. Atheist, mixed heritage, agnostic, and a Jew. So, yeah. Walk into a bar.
But no, I mean, that's what I had always been made to understand was the thing of it. And I think in Black Narcissus and in Benedetta, I mean, there's that great line where she's like, I talked to God and he didn't mention you. Where it's like, it's really just about proving that a guy likes you more than this other girl he's been flirting with.
Truly, honestly, one of the strongest reads I think I've ever, like, not to kind of make it all kind of reality TV pithiness, but, like, what a read.
I do also love that one of the main things that Mr. Dean is just always in shorts.
Short pants, showing a lot of pale.
A lot thigh. Of leg. Yeah. Because that's necessary to win, I mean, over the nuns.
We see this in Renoir's The River as well, where it's a small family in India, and it's the same guy, like a strapping young lad in short pants, just driving women mad.
It's quite a nice flip on the kind of old, you know, it's like instead of the miniskirt, it's like, wow, we really want to see men's legs and sexualize them for them.
I don't know if we need more of that. My husband once accused me of, like, watching football because, like, I was excited to see men in shorts, and I was just like, that you simply do not understand how female sexuality works. Like, I don't know that we're, like, that thrilled by a calf.
I definitely know women who are thrilled by the cut of baseball players' pants, and that is a significant component.
Well, a baseball player's pants is a very different thing, Charles. And that's also full length.
Fair enough.
And hugs the curves.
those become see-through, too. Yeah, it's leaving nothing to the imagination.
But, I mean, do you know a woman that's, like, particularly into, like, a pair of shorts? I don't know that that's true.
Well, I feel like now with the whole Paul Mescal and Jeremy Allen White fascinations, people have kind of, the sexualization of men's legs has gone.
The one I was going to bring up, and this is cultural, but in the American South, in the Gulf Coast, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, what have you, the whole Southern preppy look is all about mid-calf shorts on guys. And especially they want you to tuck your button down into the shorts, which is doubly stupid. But if you're in a Southern sorority, that's catnip to you.
Oh, yeah. And what could be sexier than, like, those famed people of, I don't know, Charleston?
I can't account for it, but I saw it happen with my own two eyes.
Yeah, I do. It's not something for me, but I appreciate that they've decided that that's, like, a necessary part of his character.
I love shorts. You know, when it's hot out, I need to let my legs breathe. But I would never convince myself that this is some sort of gift to the women of the world.
And also, like, that's what you where every time you went to address nuns. I feel like every time I've ever entered a religious building, I always try and, you know, you cover your shoulders and you don't wear shorts. So the idea that he's just like, I'm just going to rock up, pins out.
That's a good point, actually, which is something that I think about watching this movie every time, Black Narcissus, that is, to what extent do you think this guy knows what he's doing and that he likes sort of, you know, exciting these nuns and is doing this stuff on purpose? Because there's a, at first it seems like, you know, he's innocently minding his own business, but you get a sense that he actually likes this attention that's being lavished on him.
Absolutely, yeah. He's not, I don't think that he's in any way innocent in inciting their jealousies.
I do just feel, though, that in terms of, like, just outward, like, costuming, this was, like, perhaps, like, one of the first ones that really, like, explored the, like, drama of a habit. Like, you know, we've got this sort of contrasting black and white. We've got, like, these geometrical shapes. We've got kind of the ability to sort of spin in a way that, like, you know, really lends itself to the kind of, to the gaze of cinema. Like, it was wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, the habit, you know, as you mentioned, it's black and white, and we have all these shots of them working the garden, like tending the garden, which are shot in the luscious Technicolor you've ever seen in your entire life. They're against these brilliant skies, these brilliant sunsets, and that contrast of, like, how lush and how especially sensuous everything in nature is. There's the scene where they have that beautiful, juicy red tomato and none of the nuns even want to eat it because that is too much indulgence for them. You see, like, the severity and the minimalism of the habit against the verdant extravagance of the natural world. That's a really important contrast for the film.
Absolutely gorgeous. I mean, none of the films this week have, I think, persuaded any of us to convert.
I would like to go to a nunnery. I don't think I'd like to convert, but I'd definitely like to visit.
Oh, well,
yeah.
In the sort of paraphrase words of Hamlet, get thee away from a nunnery.
Get Charles away from a nunnery.
I wouldn't mind one of those little, in Immaculate, she's got some really good, the undergarment, the nightgown thing. I wouldn't mind one of those. So if I can convert, just get some, like, well-made clothes for once that I don't have to pay extreme amounts of money for and then come back. Can I do that?
I think that would be fair. I wonder, like, do nuns have to wear, like, sports bras or, like, bandoliers or something under their wimples or whatever? I don't know.
I don't think you should even be asking those questions.
How dare you?
I would appreciate that. What sort of bra are you wearing? Especially with Sydney Sweeney. She's had enough questions about
Well, I'm not asking her that. I'll Google this after this. God,
maybe it's like Mormons and there's, like, specific garments.
This is my question. So I think it's a question worth asking. Whatever.
I don't know that it is, but
none of this matters.
I support you in this endeavor and I will be interested for the
answer. I will say that I feel like they move slowly enough that they don't need to be wearing sports bras.
I don't know if they need Charles.
I'm talking about supporting women in the most literal sense.
On that note, Charles's favorite film, Black Narcissus, for completely normal reasons.
Doesn't matter.
No, an absolute masterpiece. I'm so glad I got to talk about it with you guys. But before we let our listeners go, we're going to do one last thing where you guys are going to recommend something that isn't a movie. Billy, do you want to go first? I'm going to put Charles second because I'm worried it's going to be... I'm worried it's going to be the bra nun thing. But like,
so, I recommend a really good type of shapewear. Yeah, I recommend... there's a book that came out in February that it's not gotten the attention I think it deserves. It's called Jonathan Abernathy, You Are Kind by Molly McGee. It actually also came out in America a few months prior. I would say it's the closest writing to Douglas Adams I've ever read. And it's basically like it's been compared to Severance. It's basically about a guy whose job is to take people's dreams away or nightmares so that they can be more productive in the working world. And it's disturbing in times. It's really emotional. Yeah. And it's also just got this satire and commentary on anti-capitalism, commentary on capitalism that I think is very well done.
Oh, that sounds absolutely phenomenal. Well, is it available as an audiobook? Because I don't know that I know how to
read
it.
Good question. Yeah, probably. I think it'd be a good audiobook because there's a really good narrator's voice for it. So.
Ah, God, what a hellscape we live in.
But don't go to sleep listening to it because it's about nightmares. So you'll just end up having the nightmares that they're getting taken away.
What, you guys go to sleep in quiet? Surely not.
No, but just you can't sleep to something that's about nightmares. You'll get nightmares.
Oh, fair enough.
You'll infiltrate your subconscious.
True. I actually go to sleep mostly to a podcast called Best Friends, where it's just like two people talking about like their friendship. It's just like a nice way to lull you up.
I always go to sleep to BoJack Horseman. I think that says worrying things.
Oh, no.
My psyche. Yeah.
Am I a freak that I go to sleep usually just to perfect quiet? And if that's not working, I'll put on white noise rain sounds.
Wow. That's impressive. You're like,
you do have an unusual sleep schedule, to be fair.
Yeah, maybe if I fell asleep to TV or a podcast, I would sleep through the night instead of waking up at like 5:30 a.m.
Try BoJack. It's great.
I'll try that. My recommendation is not a movie, but it is kind of movie adjacent. The great playwright Annie Baker has her first feature coming out this summer in the U.S. in June. It's called Janet Planet. It's really, really good. And I wanted to bone up for that. And people who have not seen it can get ready for that by reading her plays. I've been having a great time. There's a very handy volume that collects what she calls the Vermont plays, which is a series of four plays all set around Vermont. They're called Circle Mirror, Transformation, The Aliens, Nocturama, and Body Awareness. They're all really, really good. And if this is a selling point for you, they're quick reads. Her style on stage revolves a lot around pauses and silence. And so you're reading the book, and she very clearly denotes how much empty space should be between each line of dialogue. But unless, you know, you're mentally counting that in your head, it's a pretty quick read. But yeah, she writes incredible plays. It's like reading O'Neill about all these people who basically just hang out in one location and in the course of talking about whatever reveal these incredible depths of tragedy and resilience and sadness and hope. And it's really, really good. She's amazing. And you can see all this in the movie. It's one of my favorites of the year.
Oh, Charles, you're about to have so many regrets that you have unlocked a Annie Baker stan. To such an extent that I almost put Pulp Fiction on my top 10 for sight and sound, not because I thought that, but because of the protagonist of the flick thought that, and I wanted to honor him, a non-real life person. I had something from her play John read aloud at my wedding, actually, where, you know, like the segment where a woman kind of describes it, where she's going through an airport and meeting the person that she's going to fall in love with, and she just says, if this is possible, anything is possible.
Oh my God, that's beautiful. I had no idea.
So let's get into Annie B. So, but I'm so excited for Janet Planet. I mean, is it kind of the sort of similar thing of her, you know, her plays? Is it kind of like, you know, a sort of kind of set in a couple of locations, but then like kind of speaking to human existence in a more profound way?
This is, I mean, the thing that's really exciting about it, that I find it to be such a rewarding first film, is that she is someone who has really thought about the differences between the stage and the cinema. A lot of her plays are about movies, and her movie also features a girl who is obsessed with creating this little proscenium in her bedroom, but she really, really understands the unique formal features of each of these mediums. And I think the way she uses the elapsing of time, the way she uses space, are kind of following up on the way she stages her plays, but like you were saying, opening them up. She works in more than one location, and she actually cares about the way a shot is assembled. She cares about camera filters. Like, the look of the film is so central to it. It's set in the 90s, and so there's a lot of nostalgia, and the look is key to that. And she's just, like, she moves through this with so much confidence, like, for a first film. There are all these open spaces, just like in her plays, but you can create movement on the screen in a way that you can't on stage. She's focused on leaves blowing in the air, just, you know, the way grass moves, the way light moves. It's she's so good. It's so good. You're gonna love it.
Oh, I'm so excited, because it doesn't always translate. I mean, my sister is a theater director and film director, and, you know, skilled at both, but you see someone like a Sam Mendes and it's just like, he's so good at theater, and then something happens where he's so conventional on the screen. So yeah, very excited to hear that, like, Annie Baker's not falling into that trap.
Yeah, big one to watch this year.
What a thrill. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or email us at lwlies. Next week, Godzilla takes on Kong in New Empire and Trauma is Complicated in The Sweet End. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoy the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Billy Walker and Charles Promesco. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.